Director of the Sunlight Nutrition and Health Research Center, that's in San Francisco, and that's an entity that's devoted to research, education, and advocacy relating to prevention of chronic disease through changes in diet and lifestyle. His primary mission is to identify and quantify risk-modifying factors for chronic diseases. And he's going to talk to us about reducing the burden of disease. Dr. Grant.
Thank you, Azzy, and thank you for attending today. Let's see, we're going from here. I do have some funding from the UV Foundation in McLean, Virginia. I never could get any grants for research funded, so I just get a little stipend. Turns out that doing ecologic studies is not a big money winner. I'm going to discuss, based on some of the work of Cedric Garland and co-workers and others, I'm going to try to estimate the economic burden to the healthcare system for low vitamin D in the United States. And the healthcare in the United States costs about 16% of the gross domestic product. In 2007, the GDP was around $13.8 billion, which would imply an economic burden of health in the United States around $2.2 trillion. There's also an indirect economic burden, which is quite large. And given all the financial instability these days, I've been reading about people now not being able to afford their medicines on top of their rent, their gasoline, their food, I think we've got to try to find alternative sources. It turns out, jump ahead to one of the conclusions, you can get a year's supply of 3,000 IU of vitamin D per day for about $5 or $6 on the internet. So it's a very, very inexpensive health prevention method. Here are some of the economic burdens of disease for some of the more important vitamin D sensitive diseases. For cancer, we're talking about $228 billion, coronary heart disease, $156 billion. And I think these are the direct plus indirect burdens. You look at deaths, we're talking 566,000 cancer deaths per year, 451,000 coronary heart disease deaths, and so on. So we're really talking about major diseases that we're now learning are vitamin D sensitive. So the goal is to estimate the burden of disease can be reduced if everyone had at least 40 nanograms per milliliter, with the current mean around 25 to 30 nanograms per milliliter. And it could be that what Cedric says is that maybe we've got to shoot for 50 or 60 nanograms, but certainly we've got to be above the 25 to 30 that we are now from diet and UVB and a little bit of supplements. The Garland brothers, Frank's in the audience as well, really, in my estimation, ushered in the era of recognition of the non-calcemic health benefits of solar UVB and vitamin D. Before that, I mean, there was tuberculosis near the beginning of the 20th century. There was rickets, but that was about it until 1980. And this is the kind of map they looked at, but of course the map they looked at only had 5 color scales instead of 10, which meant it was very difficult to see the effect, and they only saw it for colon cancer. Of course, they used the contours of average annual sunlight. But when I came along in the year 2000 and saw the new set of data, I was struck by how similar all of the cancer maps looked, not only breast and colon, but prostate, kidney, stomach, and it turns out there were 14 types of cancer that had very similar patterns. And of course, you do have other things like for stomach cancer, high correlation, high red along the Mexican border, and that's probably due to H. pylori infection from poor sanitation in Mexico, which is a big risk factor for stomach cancer. And even in Northern California, it turns out that drinking alcohol in Marin County is an important risk factor for breast cancer. Now, for what I use in my studies is summertime UVB. This is why I worked for NASA at the time when I started my studies. And this is July 1992 data from the Total Ozone Mapping Spectrometer. And what you see is a great asymmetry in the UVB at the surface in July. That has two primary sources, reasons. One is that surface elevation in the west is generally higher than in the east, so we have less intervening atmosphere to attenuate the UVB. And the other is that the prevailing westerly winds cross the Rocky Mountains, and they push the air mass up, and it makes a thinner stratosphere. So we have less ozone to attenuate the UVB. And so it's very, very important here that you get this asymmetry, because when you look at these maps for kidney cancer, stomach cancer, and breast cancer, you see that the northeast has much higher rates than in the southwest. Prostate cancer is really more of a latitudinal effect, and it's another story, but I think that's more due to wintertime vitamin D rather than summertime vitamin D. And I have a manuscript in press suggesting that it's a viral or other infection in youth that is an important risk factor for prostate cancer. Turns out a lot of whereas if you look at the breast and colon cancer data, you see that this pre-diagnostic serum 25-hydroxy-D has a very good inverse correlation with the cancer outcome in 5 or 10 years. That's not the case with prostate cancer. You find an effect early in life, you find an effect on survival, you do not find an effect 5 to 10 years in advance, which is why another reason I think has to do with something with wintertime and infections. We go on history more later, but there, in my opinion, there are about 14 vitamin D-sensitive cancers, those listed here, and I think melanoma is probably one that can be added too. As Ed Gorham has shown, sunscreen use is associated with increased risk of melanoma, and that's partly because it's not letting the UVB through to produce the vitamin D, but it's also letting through more of the UVA, which is the primary risk factor for melanoma. So our good-intentioned dermatologists who've been trying to reduce the risk of skin cancer and melanoma may have been giving bad advice when they said use sunscreen, because it seems to be counterproductive in terms of melanoma. We don't understand the mechanisms. In fact, we're still developing mechanisms, but one of the important things is that vitamin D seems to be very effective in fighting cancer at the latter stages, because it's reducing angiogenesis and metastasis, as well as probably affecting cadherin and cohesion. So we have a lot of good data. I'm estimating 25, maybe 30% of cancer could be reduced if everybody had the higher serum 25-hydroxy-D levels. Going to coronary heart disease, that's one that I could not show with the ecological approach. There's just not a good geographical variation. However, there have been 6 studies this year on cardiovascular disease. You've got the Wang was the first from the Framingham. Then you had Ed Giovannucci at Harvard. You have Dobnig and Pills in Germany with stroke and coronary heart disease. And so these are case controller cohort studies showing the amount of serum 25-hydroxy affects either the risk of incidence or mortality from the cardiovascular diseases. We seem to understand some of the mechanisms: increased calcium absorption, reducing blood pressure, reducing risk of infection, increasing insulin sensitivity, etc. Type 2 diabetes, there are a couple of good observational studies finding a benefit there. Appears that the mechanisms include regulating plasma calcium levels, which regulates insulin synthesis and secretion, and also direct action of pancreatic beta cell function. It may also improve insulin sensitivity. The infectious disease is really, in my opinion, a very important and very hot topic these days. I was, several of us were invited by John Cannell to be on his seminal paper in 2006, in which he built on the earlier paper by, I'm getting ahead of myself. Well, first of all, what happens is, the 125 version of metabolite of vitamin D induces production of human cathelicidin, or LL37. It's a polypeptide with modest antimicrobial and potent anti-endotoxin activities. There's strong evidence that it fights bacterial infections. Liu et al. At UCLA have shown the effect on tuberculosis and whatever they are. I'm a physicist, not a biologist, so you have to bear with me on some of these things. But then Alioa and Li Ning had a vitamin D supplementation study with black postmenopausal women on Long Island. And those taking 2,000 IU per day got one-tenth as many colds or influenza as those taking the placebo. Those taking 800 IU per day had 40%. So here was a serendipitous finding. It was a post hoc analysis, but it still had strong support for viral protection. So Edgar Hope Simpson, 1981, pointed out influenza outbreaks were inversely correlated with solar UV. He thought that perhaps the UV was killing the virus. Well, John Cannell came along, and he's a psychiatrist who works at Tascadero, and he'd been supplementing his patients with vitamin D and found that his patient didn't get the influenza one season when everybody else did. So that spurred him on to think about it, and he wrote a paper in 2006 with a hypothesis, and then the paper next year, as a letter to the editor, supported it with their finding. And here's their data, which I've just discussed. The blue is placebo, the red is the 800 nanograms, the white one case is with 2,000 IU. Now, another important finding appears to be that in case of a pandemic influenza, vitamin D could help reduce the mortality rate. Recent studies by Brundage and Shanks and even Fauci and others have shown that bacterial pneumonia was the proximate cause of death in most cases in the 1918-1919 pandemic influenza. People died maybe 10 years after getting the infection, whereas the flu would be the first 4 or 5 days, but these were actually bacterial pneumonia, probably because the flu weakened their response, their surface or something in the lungs, and the bacteria took over. So I found a paper from 1932 which had the data for the case fatality data for 12 cities in the United States during the pandemic influenza of 1918-1919. And it turns out either summer or wintertime UVB was significantly inversely correlated with the case fatality rate during that. And because this is due to bacteria, it's very logical that LL37 would be beneficial. It was helping the innate immune system. It turns out that to really fight the virus in the first place, one needs the adaptive immunity. And in the South Pacific, the islands that survived the pandemic were those who put up a quarantine, put up a wall, and did not allow foreigners in. Those that still had open borders had very high mortality rates because they didn't have any adaptive immunity to the virus. So this is not saying that vitamin D fights a pandemic influenza virus, but it fights the bacterial infection after it. And given the difficulty in preparing viruses in case of a pandemic influenza, this finding may be very important. A study in Germany found an effect on stroke. Tooth loss is another thing I've started to study. You can lose teeth by two primary means. Below the age of 45, it's mainly through dental caries. After the age of 45, it's primarily through periodontal disease. Well, there is a paper from the 1930s that looked at dental caries among adolescents, males, and found that those with more than 3,000 hours of sunlight per day in the Southwest had something like half as many caries per tooth per mouth as those who in the Northeast with about 2,200 hours of sunlight per day. That was repeated in a study of veterans in the 1953 paper. And then we also have papers by Dietrich et al. Showing that periodontal diseases are linked to low serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D. Septicemia is another bacterial disease. Looking at the epidemiology in the United States based on season, geographic location, race, comorbid diseases, it's all strongly correlated with, inversely correlated with solar UVB. And I just have a manuscript accepted suggesting that 25% of at least 25% of the case could be reduced if people in hospitals particularly had adequate serum 25-hydroxy D. So, there we are, okay. Here is a sort of a table of what I estimate is how much reduction we could have in death rates, deaths in the United States. I've taken the deaths on the left for these different diseases. I've taken an estimate of the benefit of vitamin D, somewhere around 20-25% for each disease. I then multiply the two and get a reduction in deaths per year. And that comes out to be about 15% reduction in mortality rate when you add them all up. Well, there's a new study by Melamed et al. Who looked at NHANES 3 data and found a 26% difference in mortality rate for those less than 17.8 nanograms versus more than 32 nanograms per milliliter. So this is sort of, this is 26%, I found a 15%. They're in the same, given the uncertainty of the two calculations, I think they're very comparable. If we look at the change in the economic burden, again, I've done the same sort of thing, and I'm finding about $185 billion savings to the economy. Cost of supplements would be about $2 billion, based at $6 per person per year, and administration and testing would cost more. So I'm estimating a benefit to cost ratio of somewhere between 25 and 100 to 1. And given the high cost of drugs, the worsening economic situation, I think this is a very useful approach to consider. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Grant. Now, Carol Vaggerly is the director of Grassroots Health. It's a public health promotion organization solely focused on getting the message out about vitamin D. She's just returned from a nationwide tour giving lectures about vitamin D to interested parties. Now she's launching a nationwide health campaign called D-Action,